we're talking about some of the constituencies in the north of England where they haven't voted anything but Labour since 1922. So this is a realignment on a really different scale.
Hello and welcome to this British election special of the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Yes, we generally stick to American politics, but we've checked in on British politics from time to time over the past year, and there is big news to check in on. Yesterday's election in the UK resulted in a major victory for the Conservative Party. They exceeded expectations, winning at least a 78-seat majority in Parliament, picking up seats that have long voted for Labour. This now paves the way for Prime Minister Boris Johnson to secure a deal to take Britain out of the European Union. So here with me to discuss everything that happened and what's to come are two professors that regular listeners will be familiar with as our Brexit experts, or Brexperts, if you will. David Runciman is the head of the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge. Hello, David.
Hi, Galen.
And Helen Thompson is a professor in the Cambridge Department of Politics and International Studies, focusing on political economy. Hello, Helen.
Hi, Galen.
They also host the podcast Talking Politics, which I highly recommend. So I have a lot of questions, but let's begin with this simple one. David, why was it such a good night for conservatives, such a bad night for Labour? What do you credit?
You can credit it to two things, and each one can be summed up in one word. One of the words is Brexit. The other word is Corbyn. And they are tangled up together. It's not totally clear how you separate them out. The seats that the Conservative Party won, they won primarily in the middle of England, the Midlands, as we call it, and the north of England. These were almost all Brexit voting seats. But there's clear evidence on the ground. It's anecdotal, but it's also going to be backed up, I think, in the analysis afterwards, that many traditional Labour voters in these seats were not prepared to vote for Jeremy Corbyn for a range of reasons, some of them to do with Brexit, because his position on Brexit was much less clear than Boris Johnson. And with Boris Johnson, you knew what you were voting for. And that's the big difference this time compared to Theresa May 2 years ago, who tried to set up the same dynamic. She stood for Brexit and the Labour Party stood for chaos, but it wasn't so convincing then. It was more convincing now. But the Corbyn factor does have a lot to do with it.
Yeah, Helen, I was watching the BBC last night, and there was plenty of debate over whether to credit Brexit or Corbyn. Is it clear that one was more responsible than the other?
I think there's two different ways of looking at it, and they yield slightly different conclusions. The first way is to say, what were the people who are out canvassing for Labour hearing about most on the doorsteps from the voters who cost them, who brought about their defeat? And I think the answer is it's pretty clear it was Corbyn. It was top of the negativity that they were hearing, and it was a visceral, you know, almost hatred, certainly visceral dislike that was being expressed by many Labour and former Labour voters. I think, though, it's also clear that if you look at where Labour performed most poorly last night, it was in the most Leave constituencies. So I think that at a certain point, the two effects reinforce each other, because the people who hated Corbyn because he comes over to them as not a patriot were also the people who were probably most likely to have strong views about Brexit.
I'm sure that it's going to take some time to look through the exit polls and the profile of the voters who switched. But at this point, what do we know about who the swing voters were?
They're basically, it would seem anyway, from what we can see so far, is working class and lower middle class voters in the West Midlands, the East Midlands, the North East, the North West, and the North of Wales. Really the only sort of traditional Labour area outside the big urban cities that stood up seems to be the Rhondda Valley in the South Wales, basically the heartland of the old South Welsh coal industry. Other than that, Labour was simply doing extraordinarily poorly by historical standards with these kind of voters who, not just themselves, but you know, their families have considered themselves Labour, not just in an electoral sense, but in some sense as a social identity too.
And just to add one thing, I think the exit polling and the analysis would also show that they will tend to have been older voters. So the Labour vote does seem to have held up well. I mean, turnout is always a question, and it seems that turnout among younger voters is slightly down on last time, not massively. But among the people who did vote, those who switch from Labour to Conservative, I think, will turn out to be predominantly over the age of 40.
I think we're going to hear a lot of hot takes in the US media about whether or not there are any conclusions we can draw from the British election about American politics. And obviously, it's a very different political system facing very different issues. But I know that you also cover American politics. So given what you said about who these swing voters were and similarities that one could easily draw if they wanted to, how much do you think you can draw a comparison between what happened last night and the current map or the current state of American politics?
I mean, there are a lot of ways we could go with this. I mean, Helen might have something to say about this. I would be wary about mapping people onto people, Corbyn onto Sanders, though. Not just different systems, very different histories, very different backgrounds. I was struck yesterday by the fact that Ocasio-Cortez sent her support for Jeremy Corbyn. And she explicitly said this is a youth movement and this is this is a vote that needs to come out for young people. And I've been saying this for a while. There aren't enough young people to win elections. And I think there is a lesson here about the generation divide and the education divide in our politics, ours and yours, which are getting more and more acute. They come out in geographical divides too, different parts of the country. But when you break voters down, you can see that whether or not you went to college, how old you are key determinants of how you vote. And one lesson I would take as a Democrat, whatever the policy positions are, is you've got to reach across that generation divide. And if you don't, if the appeal is not limited to but concentrated on younger voters, you're going to be outnumbered.
I think that there's something to be learned for the Democrats from the fact that in economic terms, that the Labour Party moved as far to the left as it did under Corbyn. And this isn't really about any specific policy, but it all added up to something that simply didn't sound credible. I mean, not just not credible, it sounded fantastical. That there's no way that any government could come in with this kind of programme and even remotely competently exercise it. So even if you can say that individual policies have got reasonable degree of popular support, then the whole thing adds up to something that just looks like, have these people lost their minds?
For an American audience, what exactly did that economic policy look like?
Well, it involved a fair amount of nationalization. It was going to involve huge amounts of borrowing that was going to be directed at a Green New Deal. It was going to, at some point, so they seem to sort of move back from this position during the course of the election. It was going to involve moving to a four-day working week. It was going to involve an immediate 5% increase for all workers in the public sector. And they were going to entirely scrap the reforms to the benefit system, a system called Universal Credit, which has been incredibly problematic and caused huge amounts of problems. But I think that the idea that you could then simply address those problems by scrapping something that has started from good intentions and proved some and produced some disastrous outcomes, and that would somehow make things better. It just didn't add up to the sense that these were people who had thought through a way of governing the country through a set of policy commitments. But I think that the other thing is that the thing that's really different, though, there's two things that are really different and they just aren't there. Is the first of them is that if Bernie Sanders is treated as Jeremy Corbyn, they're just not like each other, because Bernie Sanders simply does not have the history with security issues that Jeremy Corbyn has, and the kinds of people that Corbyn's been willing to associate himself with over the years. And the second thing is that we had a referendum that initially the majority of MPs in Parliament were willing to accept the outcome of, and then at a certain point, I'd say some point late last year, they became much less willing to accept and wanted to, in some sense, to stop, to prevent the implementation of Brexit. So it became an issue about democratic politics itself, and that isn't there, I think, in the case of the United States. Now, you might say it comes into play if you go down the impeachment, if the Democrats are completely and utterly committed in an uncompromising way to impeaching Donald Trump, but I still don't think it's quite the same.
And just to add to what Helen was saying about the implausibility of the programme, it does also cut across the Brexit issue. The Johnson strategy was to present a stark contrast between a deliverable policy on Brexit, where people understood what it meant, that he had a deal, and if you elected him, as will now happen, that deal will pass the House of Commons, and on the Labour side, something that was not just, for many people, confusing, but felt incoherent. It's not clear to people how it would happen. Even if you understood what it was, and occasionally Corbyn defended it quite competently and said it, you know, there was a clear strategy there, how it would happen, how it would get through the Commons, how it would be turned into policy. And something of that then chimes with this sense that here's a manifesto, even if you understand it involves, I mean, one of the ones Helen didn't mention, free broadband, the nationalisation of all broadband and then making available free. That's easy to understand. Your broadband will be free. But how? People, I think, you know, voters have an instinctive suspicion of things where even if they understand the what, they don't understand the how.
When it comes to maybe not just even policy comparisons, because obviously it's a very different context, the left in America does not really necessarily compare to the left in Britain. But when it comes to demographic divides like ones you were already talking about, David, I was watching the BBC last night and a Johnson advisor brought up Pennsylvania in the United States as an example of this global electoral change that we're seeing where the white working class is backing conservatives. Is that a fair conclusion to draw, that there's some kind of global or Western, at least, electoral realignment?
So part of my answer to that will be this is a long process. This isn't something that's dramatic and recent. Margaret Thatcher brought some of the white working class over to the conservatives a generation ago. I think one of the things that makes it different is what we see in this increasing education divide. So Labour did well last night in some places. It did well in London. It did well in university towns. And there is a strong connection here again with Brexit. Remain voting parts of the country tended to be very close to either universities or places where there are a significant number of graduates. And you see that the Labour Party still has a strong appeal in those places. Helen and I are sitting in one now, Cambridge. Cambridge was a safe and solid Labour hold last night. It feels like a very Labour seat now, but it's not poor by any stretch of the imagination. Though there are, of course, you know, huge inequalities here. So that feels to me to be new, relatively new, and it's playing out geographically. So you can call it Pennsylvania, you can call it the Rust Belt, you can call it the bits of Britain that feel maybe post-industrial left behind. But I think the demography is more complicated than that. And I also think that age is a crucial factor here too. So Labour did do well also where there were concentrations of younger people, people who rent housing and who are suffering in a very tight housing market. But you know, the other thing I think that does connect with the position of Democrats is that these votes are often very concentrated. So they pile up in some places. And if you have a first-past-the-post system, whether it's constituencies or states, as in the Electoral College, you're in trouble if you're piling up votes in very small, geographically condensed areas, and if the opposition are more spread out. And that's what happened here.
I think the other thing I would say is that where the Pennsylvania comparison doesn't really work is that Pennsylvania, obviously, you know, like voted for Nixon, voted twice for Reagan. We're talking about some of the constituencies in the north of England where they haven't voted anything but Labour since 1922. So this is a realignment on a really different scale. Now, I think that David's absolutely right that some of these seats have been actually trending in this direction for some time. If you take, for example, there's a seat in a place called Stoke in the West Midlands, Stoke North. And basically, after Blair won in 1997, is the turnout then the next general election fell by a long way. And then each sort of general election on, the Labour majority's been, you know, chipped away at. And then last night it became a Conservative seat. So the story of why these places have given up on the Labour Party isn't just about the last few years. It's much longer than that. I think it is to do with what happened, both the New Labour project and the economic change in these former industrial areas. But I just wouldn't want people, your listeners here, to miss the magnitude of the change that's happening in some parts of the north of England in particular.
Can we zoom in on that? You mentioned some seats that have been Labour since the 20s going Conservative. As political scientists, political observers, how big of a surprise was last night's result?
I personally, it didn't feel like a shock on the scale that some recent elections have felt, in that there was always a reasonable probability, and the polls were certainly pointing this way, including some of the most reliable polls, that Johnson would win a majority of more than 40 and possibly as large as 80, which is where he is now. And the polls weren't massively out in this election. The average of polls is close to the final result. I think some of the shock does come from the fact that in certain seats in particular, the swing is huge. So some of these seats haven't just flipped. They've gone from being Labour seats to being seats with huge Tory majorities in 10,000 plus, what we would now call safe Conservative seats. So that scale of it feels surprising. There's also, I think, some element of surprise, although maybe there shouldn't be, in the fact that, you know, we keep almost forgetting this in British politics. Boris Johnson is a consistent winner, but he always surprises when he wins. He surprised people when he became Mayor of London. He surprised people when he won the Brexit referendum. He surprised people when he became Prime Minister. And now he surprised people again. Maybe it's our mistake to be surprised, but I still felt that element of it last night. He has reached parts of the electorate that no other Conservative politician can reach.
I always thought that there was a strange distribution of probabilities around this election, and that because there was this large pool of potential first-time Conservative voters, that it was always possible that a significant number of them would lose their nerve in the polling booth, sort of, in some sense, go into the polling booth and encounter a lot of ghosts who would be sort of telling them that what on earth were they doing voting Conservative. But the other part of me thought it was just as possible that they could go into the polling booth with the same ghosts and that the ghosts would be telling them that I'd hate Corbyn even more than you do, or I'm completely affronted that your Brexit vote's been, you know, ignored. And if that was the sort of the mindset, then it was this significant pool of potential first-time Conservative voters could yield the Conservatives a large majority, and that's the way that it's turned out. But I don't think that we should sort of underestimate the fact that I don't think it was all determined in some sense. In that, I think that this sort of crossing a psychological barrier for the voters in the kinds of constituencies we were talking about to vote Conservative is a big deal.
Yeah, you mentioned whether or not this was accurately reflected in the pre-election polling. Can we get into a little bit more of the specifics there? What kind of spread was it showing? Can we consider last night a success for the polls?
Yeah, I mean, because it's a complex first-past-the-post system with multiple regional variations, you know, the huge complexity, which no doubt we'll touch on in a minute, of Scotland as being effectively a separate electorate now. Northern Ireland is separate. Wales has behaved more like England in this election, but still is more complex. We still tend to look at the headline figure, the party vote share. And the polls, the spread was, I think it averaged out at about a 9.5-point difference that the Tories were ahead, and they're going to end up pretty close to that. The poll that was most successful last time in predicting it, a constituency-based poll, and predicting to everyone's surprise that in 2017 we weren't going to see a Tory majority. This time, 2 weeks before the result, this was a YouGov poll, predicted a 68-seat majority, which is pretty close and got a lot of the constituencies right. They then lost their nerve, and they ran another one a couple of days ago, which brought that 68 down to 28. The one 2 weeks ago turned out to be more accurate, as their one 2 weeks out in 2017 did. So this has done something to restore faith in polling, but I think there's still a sense that that headline figure is crude. The other one that is consistent is the gap between Johnson and Corbyn's approval ratings, which a lot of people take as a better guide. And though Corbyn closed the gap a bit, Johnson was significantly ahead even at the end, 15 plus points, whereas in 2017, Corbyn closed the gap on May to effectively nothing. And that should have been the sign to those of us who, with hindsight, now realise it was telling us what was going to happen.
I think the other interesting thing on the pollsters is that the company that's actually probably done best, if you think about it, over the two elections, 2017 and 2019, is Servation, which is, interestingly, does phone polling, doesn't do online polling.
Yeah, that's generally a factor that we take into consideration in the U.S. as well, who's doing landline, phone, cell phone-based polling and who's just doing it online. And we see that oftentimes live phone calls are the most effective way of doing polling. I want to get into some of what this means for the future of Brexit and how the election shook out in terms of the minor parties. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. We've all heard of Casper. You know, the sleep company with outrageously comfortable products at not so outrageous prices. From award-winning mattresses to pillows, sheets, and duvets, Casper transforms the way you sleep, one snooze at a time. Casper is the perfect place to get all of your holiday shopping done because, let's be honest, everybody sleeps. And as always, Casper has free shipping and free returns. Plus, every Casper mattress comes with a 100-night risk-free trial. The stress of holiday shopping doesn't need to keep you up at night. Casper has gifts for everyone who sleeps. Go to casper.com/politics now and use code GIFTS for $25 off gifting orders over $100. Shop for friends and family. And hey, while you're there, treat yourself to something as well. That's casper.com/politics, code GIFTS, for $25 off gifting orders over $100. Offer expires December 24th, 2019. Terms and conditions apply. See casper.com/terms. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. The holidays are here. This year, give yourself the gift of extra money in your pocket. Pay off your credit card balances and save with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Roll your high-interest credit card payments into just one payment at a lower fixed rate. Lightstream's credit card consolidation loans have rates as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. Plus, there's absolutely no fees, no application fees, no origination fees, no transaction fees, no prepayment penalties. The application is so quick and easy, you can apply right from your phone. Just for listeners, apply now and get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. All right, we're back. And as you mentioned, David, before the break, of course, there are multiple parties in the UK, and the election in Scotland last night was also very notable. So can we just run through a little bit how the minor parties did and what was surprising and what wasn't?
Okay, so I'll do a couple and Helen can do a couple. I mean, it should be said also, so we have an exit poll here, which has been very accurate in recent elections. And as soon as it came out last night, everyone accepted that Johnson was going to win the kind of majority that he did. But it did get Scotland slightly wrong. So the exit poll had the Scottish National Party winning almost every seat in Scotland, 55 out of 59, I think it is. In the end, they haven't won that many. They're in the high 40s, and the Conservative Party has held up a bit better, the Liberal Democrats a bit better in Scotland. The party that's been wiped out in Scotland just has one seat now is Labour, and that's another problem for Labour going forward. Their Scottish base has gone. What that result does is it sets up a looming confrontation, which may become the central confrontation of British politics post-Brexit, between the Scottish National Party's demand for another independence referendum and Johnson's refusal to grant it. He said he won't grant it. And Johnson can now refuse. He has a majority in Parliament. He can do effectively what he likes. But the SNP have equally got a mandate to say that the people of Scotland have voted for it. And after Brexit, when we leave, which we will do in a few weeks, that case will become stronger. So that's one of the big takeaways from this election. The other, Helen, you can do the grief of the Liberal Democrats.
The Liberal Democrats have had a bad election. They went in with a lot of hopes. There was even talk about them winning 100-odd seats. Their leader, Jo Swinson, talked about herself as a plausible prime minister. And they have, I think they've made two gains, and that it's possible they could make one more, but they've lost some seats as well.
So they have, at the moment, as we speak, they have 11 seats. They may end up with 12, which is where they started after the last election. So literally, they've gone nowhere, but they've also lost their leader.
They've lost their leader because she lost her seat. They have increased the percentage of the vote, the share of the vote that they have, but it's much less efficiently distributed, even in this small percentage that they have, than it was last time. And I think that the problem that they had was that they made choices about how to deal with the Brexit issue and the Corbyn issue that didn't really line up with the circumstances of the electoral system and the possible targets that they had for actually winning seats. So in order to make gains, they really needed to take seats away from the Conservatives. So the primary pool of voters they should have been interested in were Conservative Remain voters. But it's pretty clear that these Conservative Remain voters have largely stayed with the Conservative Party, and they have done so because they've prioritised stopping Corbyn being Prime Minister over stopping Brexit. So in order to try to have them vote Liberal Democrat, the most important thing for the Liberal Democrats would have been to do everything they possibly could to demonstrate their anti-Corbyn credentials, and that is not what Jo Swinson ended up doing.
The only other thing to say about the Liberal Democrats is, I think, though, if you look at it from the outside, it doesn't look like such a catastrophe for them. As Helen said, they've increased their vote share. They've ended up probably with as many seats as they had. They've lost their leader. But what means it will go down in the annals of British political history as one of the supreme acts of hubris is that they triggered this election. Boris Johnson was still in trouble a few months ago. Parliament had him, if not cornered, at least facing some pretty unenviable choices. And the election was his way out. And Labour, for the most part, not all of them, but many of them, were trying to resist that. And it was Jo Swinson, the Liberal Democrat leader, who made the first move, who basically opened the door for Boris Johnson. And not only has he marched through it, but he's trampled her in his wake. And I think for that reason, this election will actually be remembered, among other things, particularly, unfortunately for her, for Jo Swinson's act of hubris. And it will become a kind of morality tale. Be careful what you wish for.
From maybe a little bit more of an academic perspective, a first-past-the-post system with a bunch of parties competing is somewhat complicated, and you get a lot of plurality winners instead of majority winners. How much of a sense is there that some of the constituencies, some of the elections, were spoiled by the fact that it's a multi-party system and there were so many plurality winners?
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you mean by spoiled. The other party we haven't mentioned is the Brexit Party, which is Nigel Farage's party, that also played a part in the shape of British politics over the last year by winning our European elections and effectively triggering the demise of Theresa May and the rise of Boris Johnson. And they came to this complicated arrangement that they would stand not in Conservative seats, but only in seats that were currently held by non-Conservative candidates. They did well last night in some respects. In some of these seats, they had really significant vote shares, so that the winners were not only not having a majority, but actually quite low down in percentage terms. They do seem to have taken votes from the Labour Party as well as from the Conservative Party. The Conservatives' great fear was the Brexit Party would cost them this election because they would split the pro-Brexit vote. That didn't happen. And it does seem that some Labour voters who, with the ghost Helen was talking about, couldn't quite make the leap from Labour to Conservative, found a safe resting place in Brexit Party candidates. And so that really complicated it. There are some seats that the Conservatives might have won from Labour that they didn't because the Brexit Party took some of their vote. But there are clearly other seats that the Conservative Party did win. And turnout wasn't that high. So if you look at the numbers of votes that people are getting to win these seats, it's often not much more than 15, 16, 17,000 votes. It's not a lot of votes. It is a really complex system, even though the other thing that we have seen, even in this election, is the stranglehold of the two main parties. Outside of Scotland, Labour and the Conservatives have won almost all of the seats.
There's been a lot of discontent expressed with the electoral system. Sometimes that's been conflated with discontent with the choice of prime ministers because of the, by historical standards anyway, poor approval ratings. I mean, spectacularly poor approval ratings for Jeremy Corbyn and quite poor approval ratings for Boris Johnson. I mean, I do think those issues actually are not the same between the choices of the leaders of the party and what the dynamics of the electoral system produce in terms of privileging the two main parties. I think the interesting aspect, though, to this election in this in regard to the electoral system is that the electoral system has now played its part in settling the Brexit question. So we have had a general election that is also de facto acted as a second referendum. And the one thing that was true, that was clearly true from the beginning after the referendum in June 2016, was that on a constituency by constituency basis, that Leave had considerable advantages. So if you, I can't remember what the exact figures are, but it would have been something like, if they were distributed by seats, it would have been sort of Leave winning 65% plus of the seats. So if you're going to try to settle the Brexit question by a general election under our electoral system, then it actually was going to make it possible to do that with a party winning perhaps even as low as 42, 43% of the vote. In this case, it was a bit higher for the Conservatives. So we're now trying to establish losers' consent to the Brexit question when it's been settled in part by the electoral system. And I think that will be quite complicated for the future.
That's interesting. Maybe not so different from the Electoral College and distribution of Republican versus Democratic votes here in the States.
Well, I think that it just, if you have, shall we say, high stakes elections, and the electoral rules seem to play then some part in determining the outcome, whether that be the Electoral College or whether it be our first past the post system, and then try to sort of deal with what had been a referendum question via a general election. I do think it makes the problem of legitimating the outcome even harder than it sometimes is in democratic politics anyway.
The difference, though, of course, is that you can add up the votes and say, in the election last night, Leave got this percentage, add Tories to the Brexit Party, and then you can, at a stretch, say second referendum or Remain Party's got the other lot, and you would just about get a majority, a sort of Hillary versus Trump majority in the popular vote for the Remain option.
Or at least for the second referendum
option. Or at least for the second referendum option. But unlike in that case, it cuts across the fact that the Labour Party are the clear losers. There's no sense that there's a party that feels somehow it got screwed by this system because it would have won otherwise.
Absolutely.
And so I think that gives it a slightly different kind of edge, and actually it complicates it, but it also dissipates it a bit. I mean, the trauma that's being felt this morning in this country is the trauma of the Labour Party more than it is the trauma of Remain. But at some point, Remain is going to wake up to the fact, maybe tomorrow, that we are leaving at the end of January now, and that fight has been lost. And at that point, a different set of emotions will kick in.
Yeah, what comes next for Brexit? What does the path forward look like?
Johnson wants Parliament to pass the withdrawal agreement before Christmas, and then we would be leaving on the 31st of January. Then we move into transition arrangements and the beginnings of negotiating a new economic relationship, including a new trade agreement. That's going to be far from straightforward. There's going to be a lot of political disagreement, I think, about what kind of trade relationship we're trying to negotiate, whether there should be an extension of the transition. Boris Johnson, during the election campaign, has categorically ruled out the possibility of extending the transition, so then that we will be out of the transition arrangements by the end of 2020. But one thing I think that the large majority, or the relatively large majority he now has, means is that he will have significantly more wriggle room in relation to the ERG within the Conservative Party, and he may well, I'm not saying he will, but I think it's quite possible he will dispense with his promise about not extending the transition.
I tend to agree with that. I think it's this strange thing that some of the heat, British politics was frenetic and at points traumatic in the period, in the fall of the period before this election. There were some really fraught moments, emotions running very, very high, felt very high stakes. This election has settled a lot of that, and some of that emotion will drain away. But in a way, the stakes are still just as high, and some of the tough choices are still to be made. And one of the interesting questions is, are there points at which we're not going to, I think, quite get back to that, because that can only happen in a parliament where the governing party does not have a majority. When it has a majority, we're back in much more familiar terrain, that in a sense, the government, the executive decides. And unless they do something really stupid, their party will back them. But will there be a point at which some of that emotion returns? I'm not sure, actually. It's one of the oddities of this that things can drain away quite quickly, things can become an accepted fact quite quickly, but the stakes are just as high. I mean, in some ways they're higher. In some ways, the next phase of the negotiation is much more significant for the future prosperity and security of this country, because there are huge security questions too, than this huge fight over the withdrawal agreement, which was just about settling the past with the Irish question thrown in. And the Irish question is still not resolved, but the other thing we haven't mentioned here is that the previous parliament was dominated by one of the minor parties, the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland, which effectively at some points was holding the Conservative government to ransom. Not only did that party lose seats last night, but they have got nothing to hold over Johnson now, literally nothing. He doesn't even have to acknowledge their existence if he doesn't want to. And that changes the dynamics too. And Irish politics and Northern Irish politics played such an outsized role in British politics in the past couple of years. And again, the stakes haven't got any less high there, what this final arrangement is, where the border is it in the Irish Sea? But it won't feel the same. It definitely won't feel the same.
Is there a sense that Brexit is finally in the rearview mirror? I mean, you mentioned that obviously there are still high-stakes negotiations, but as far as popular politics are concerned, is it behind you?
No, but we're in a different stage of it. I mean, whatever the journey is to wherever we end up, what happened in the past few months will feel like a different kind of politics. But it's not behind us. I mean, it's never going to be behind us.
No, I mean, I think that it's going to take some time for the reaction to the Brexit side of this election to play itself out, because at the moment it's very much about the parties and the leaders of the parties. But you know, it's quite possible that there's still going to be a party, presumably the Liberal Democrats, that might commit to rejoining the European Union as a position. Now, I think there'll be considerable difficulties with that, but it's far. I mean, there's no way that we could say today that there isn't going to be a significant constituency of voters who are going to want that as a position that they can vote for in the future. And whether there's a party that I can't see how the Labour Party can any longer be that party, but what the Liberal Democrats will do, I think that is still an open question.
Again, as you know, 5 years is a long time in politics, and economics still matter a lot. And one thing that this election has clarified is the Conservative Party, but particularly the Boris Johnson government, now owns Brexit. It's not Theresa May's problem anymore. It's not David Cameron's problem anymore. Helen and I were just talking about the fact that David Cameron is probably breathing a bit easier this morning, because he was someone who was blamed by many people for the nightmare that we were in. And now that nightmare, at least, has receded. And the next nightmare will be Johnson's problem if there's a global recession. I mean, who knows what will happen? But Brexit will get mixed up then in people's minds, particularly once economic consequences start to kick in with whatever else is happening in the economy. And the European economy could also face some huge problems in the next 5 years. So we'll be in a different phase. And I think in some ways it will feel more familiar. It will really matter whether there's a recession or not as to what people think about Brexit. It won't just be a high constitutional question cut across populist politics. But the contingencies are still massive.
Yeah. Looking ahead for the two different parties, for the two different leaders, obviously last night is a very different story. But what does Jeremy Corbyn do now? What does Labour do now?
Well, Corbyn said last night that he won't lead the Labour Party into another general election, but that he doesn't intend immediately to resign. I think there may be some considerable pressure put upon him within the parliamentary party to speed his resignation up. But I think we can be sure that the people, Corbyn himself and the people around Corbyn, not least John McDonnell, are going to fight incredibly hard to ensure that there is a Corbyn legacy, and that will mean that the left of the Labour Party will remain in control of the party. And I think that they will have certain advantages in trying to ensure that that happens.
I think one of the problems for Corbyn is he would like a slower departure so that he can, in his words, it's a slight euphemism, oversee the transition, i.e. steer it in the direction he wants. But the politics of the next few weeks are acute. There will be a series of parliamentary events, including the vote on the withdrawal agreement bill. And in due course, as we get into the spring, there'll be a Queen's speech, the government programme, there will be a budget where the leader of the opposition plays an important role. I cannot see Corbyn standing up in the House of Commons, facing the Conservative benches, and being greeted with anything other than derision. And some of that derision would be shared on his own side too. So maybe he can stay around for 6 weeks, but the idea that he can see this through for much longer than that seems to me to be wishful thinking. And if I was a Labour Party, I would accelerate it for other reasons too. I think they need to move on.
Do you see any world in which Labour now tacks more towards the centre?
Well, the Labour Party is still very much in the hands of its members, and the members choose the leader. And the members are still committed, if not to Corbyn. I think some of them, after last night, will start to wonder what they were thinking. But to many of the policies and what sometimes now gets called Corbynism. I'm not totally sure what that is without the man himself, but at least many of those commitments are popular, and particularly popular with the members. There's still a visceral loathing of Tony Blair in the membership of the Labour Party. Again, one or two people might be starting to rethink that, because he's the only one who's won any elections for them for a generation. But even in the campaigning for this election, there were things that were sent out. Momentum, who are the organising wing of the Corbyn movement, lots of young campaigners, and they were told, go on the doorstep, and even if you don't get a hearing, get our message across. And the first thing you should do is lay into Tony Blair. Rip Blair, it said. That's step number one. That membership is not going to tack to the centre.
I think the other problem for Labour is that both the Corbyn side of the party and the centrists are both implicated in this defeat, because clearly Corbyn was near detested amongst many of these defecting voters who defected to the Conservatives. But at the same time, it's the centrists who push Labour away from the position that they had, which was to support Brexit on Labour's terms, into this second referendum position. So the Corbynistas are right when they say that some of the blame belongs with the centrists, I think, for moving Labour to a position that cost them so many Leave voters.
So the ground is set. If they want to, they could get into some internecine struggles for a while.
And now when it comes to Johnson and the Conservatives, Johnson could be Prime Minister for 5 years now, maybe more, maybe including the issue of Brexit or even beyond Brexit. What kind of Prime Minister do you expect Johnson to be?
Well, Johnson's going to have to tack to the centre now, because he's going to have to defend these Conservative seats in the former Labour Conservative seats. And that means it's going to have to be a more economically interventionist Conservative Party than we've seen in quite some time.
I think the other thing about Johnson, people sometimes think, oh, now he's got the power, we can sort of find out who he really is. We know who he really is. He's the guy he's been all along. He's a risk taker. He's not a particularly principled person or politician. He's quite willing to change tack quite dramatically. He's not especially good on his feet. He actually struggled in this campaign when the going got tough, when he was under severe questioning. It all looks rosy now. In 6 months, in a year, in 18 months, when something happens, particularly if something happens economically, his weaknesses will come to the fore too. Every British Prime Minister, when they've won a big majority in Parliament, looks for a while to be invincible, because there are so few checks and it's not obvious where the opposition is going to come from. But every politician with this kind of power quite quickly discovers its limits.
Let's leave it there. Thank you, Helen and David.
Thanks, Gailey, for asking us.
Thanks.
Helen Thompson is a professor in the Cambridge Department of Politics and International Studies, focusing on political economy. David Runciman is the head of the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge. They host the podcast Talking Politics. Also a note, stick around at the end of this podcast to hear a preview of our sports podcast, Hot Takedown, an interesting discussion about Russian doping. We'll be back to U.S. politics and impeachment coverage on Monday. Hopefully you enjoyed this hop across the pond. My name is Galen Druk. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon. One more thing, a preview from 538's sports podcast. You should already know this, but in case you don't, 538 has a sports podcast. It's called Hot Takedown. And on this week's installment, the team discussed the World Anti-Doping Agency's decision to ban Russia from the Olympics because of doping violations. But Russian athletes who have a clean record will still be able to compete. That led the Hot Takedown crew to draw some comparisons to Russian meddling in U.S. elections. So here's a preview of what they had to say, and make sure to subscribe to Hot Takedown wherever you get your podcasts.
You often hear in politics, you know, the Putin playbook. And this is the Putin playbook on full display, because look at what they did, especially in this cover-up. They deny, they deny, they deny at all costs. They never admit wrongdoing. And what do they do with this Rodchenkov? They attack the accuser. That's immediately what they went after. The person, literally the whistleblower.
It's about what we do with evidence and wrongdoing on the global stage. And it very much ties into what Russia did in the 2016 election vis-a-vis interfering with U.S. elections. What this debate and conversation is really about is what happens when the perpetrator denies the fact pattern. what should there be extra steps taken, you know, on top of whatever the initial sanction was.
But would it have been different had they banned every Russian athlete? I mean, it still would have been used as a political prop.
Yeah. And there's a risk of jingoism in which you overpunish the enemy, quote unquote, and you end up tarring a citizen of a country just because their political leader does something. And there are no easy answers here, for me at least, in the sense that I do think that it's worth raising the parallel and noting that this is another instance in which you have, to Jeff's point, sort of a fact pattern, a denial, and then a muddled response that doesn't help sort out what's true and what's not. That, as a journalist, makes my skin tingle a little bit.